Thank you, Cody. Good evening. The older I get, the more I think about God. I think that's normal. The more I think about Him, the more I study the Scriptures. And the more I study the Scriptures, the more I look at myself and look at the world that I live in, the world that we live in. And the more I do that, the more I see a connection to a lot of things that are in the Scriptures. Things that I may have been reading the Bible in the Book of Mormon for a few years, but in the last 5-10 years, things are really starting to, I guess, be on my mind or be in my heart. And I'd like to talk again tonight about God. I think that's been my last theme on the last 3 or 4 sermons, and I'm going to stay with it, I guess. But I'd like to start at the front. I'm not going to do a whole lot of reading, but I've got some comments I'd like to make. In the front of the Bible, when things first started and God created the heavens and the earth, you can compare Adam and Eve to a newborn babe because they really didn't know anything. And that's hard for us adults in this day and age to think about. But think about some adults that didn't know the difference really between right and wrong, especially as we understand today. And since they didn't, there was a behavior thing. Therefore, God does what parents do today to their newborns and their young ones. He had to micromanage. Makes sense. But also, you got to remember that from the beginning, God knew what was going to be going on with His creation forever. And He already had the rules laid out, which are all correct. And He had the plan laid out, which is absolutely correct. The only thing that wasn't correct was us. And He did that on purpose. He gave us our free agency, as we know. And there's where the problem started, was us and our free agency. In the Book of Mormon, it tells you that the natural man is an enemy to God. Always has been. Probably always will be. Because we can't think like God. We don't have the width and the depth and the wisdom and the foreknowledge and all of the things that God has at His fingertips, I guess you'd say, to know where He wants to take this creation of His. All we know about is our life and what's around us and what world we live in. And that's been the case from step one. You got all these stories in Genesis and Exodus and Leviticus and clear on through the Bible, clear through the Book of Mormon, about how things were back then at those particular times. And too many times when I'm sitting in a Sunday school class or a Bible study class or something, I become aware often, not all the time, but often, that unintentionally we put God in our own box. We think He should be this, we think He should be that, and it's because of our experiences, our traditions, what we have learned from our elders, what we see, what we want to see, our emotions, that even unintentionally, we put God in a box. And I think He knows this. Well, I'm pretty sure He knows this. So in spite of our efforts, He tries to get us down what they call a straight and narrow, which I don't think is Well, I guess it's straight. I don't know what's so narrow, because the more you get into the Word of God and the more you understand it, the more you feed it, the more freedom you got. More freedom from sin and sadness and mistakes and all that you got. And I don't see anything wrong with that. But you start off, and you get on down into where there's several people in this world instead of just Adam and Eve and their kids. And you've got people like Abram. Now, to give you an idea what Abram was, he was of the city of Ur in Macedonia. He was an honest citizen there. He was an obedient citizen there, I guess you'd say. And they worshiped the moon god of that time. When you look in the when you look on the internet, people still worship that moon god. There's websites about it. And if you take a look, they found in Mesopotamia, they found a bunch of cuneiform tablets about this moon god and his family, which he was a god. And like all pagan gods, there are multiple gods with feelings, with emotions. That's the first sign that something's wrong if you're looking for a god. And what they found out when they translated these cuneiform tablets was that if there's anything wrong in the world, this moon god did it and his family. You take half a dozen soap operas and a couple of horrible movies, put it all together, and that was the life and the actions of this moon god and his family. It's horrible. It really is horrible. The name of the moon god is Sin. That's where that word came from. People back then, when you talked about sin, they knew it was this god, and that's who they worshiped. Was this sin. And God had to deal with this. He knew that. Now, when you get into the first part of the Bible, and this is the first thing that I had trouble understanding once I had a simplified, I guess you say, understanding of who God was. It says that God separated the light from the darkness. But then in a little while on later on, he created the sun and the moon. Well, to us, that's light and darkness. I never could figure out how he created the light and the darkness before he created the sun and the moon. Until I finally hit on the first part of the book of John. And it explains what the darkness is and what the light is. It's good and evil. The first thing that surprised me about that is that God didn't destroy the evil. He separated it. He left it there. Why? Because we have choices to make. And how can you make a choice if there's only good in God's world? That shows, to me, a thinking, a maturity in thinking that's far beyond anything that I can come up with. That God knew what he was doing. God is the final authority on everything. God is always right. He's never wrong. He doesn't have to answer to anybody. And he's the one that's doing this. So what I have to do when I look at things that I consider to be a dichotomy, I got to reconcile myself to, I really don't know what I'm talking about or what I'm thinking about, but God does. So, he left the good and he left the evil, but he separated them. And then the next thing he had to do was to, I guess you'd say, wean Abraham and Sarai off of sin, because they had an entire civilization. They had all the things that civilizations have, you know, their social mores and your practices and your traditions of sin. Well, as we know, Sarai didn't have any men. She didn't have any males. The custom back then was if the wife couldn't produce a son, then the custom and the tradition was that they gave the handmaiden to the husband in hopes that she would produce a male. And that's exactly what Sarai did. But then, of course, we know the story about how Sarai became jealous and banned Hagar and all of that. Well, the angel of the Lord goes to Hagar and he tells her, you go back, you submit yourself to your master, and you will have a son. He will be a wild man. This is the 16th chapter of Genesis. He will be a wild man, and his hand will be against every man, and every man's hand will be against him. And his name will be Ishmael, which means God has heard. And that's the first Arab. And we're still dealing with Arabs, with the Arab way of thinking. You go to Pakistan, you go to, Saudi Arabia, pretty much. They're Wahhabis. And you look at how they look at life, and you look at how they look at each other, and especially how they treat women as second-class people. And that's where that comes from. That's the history of that, civilization. Because God said that they will be sand in the seas, sand in the beaches, you know. That's my way of saying it. So right off the bat, we had this contention. We had this hate. We had this sin. We had this sin before we had Christianity, obviously. And people didn't really put a lot of value on a person's life. As a matter of fact, there was very little value put on a person's life until people had the opportunity to become literate and to have access to a Bible, thanks to Mr. Gutenberg. And it was only then that people started putting a value on a human life. And you go back and you look and you read in the scriptures and you look at the way that they treated, as far as history goes, how they treated the people that built the pyramids, the workers, and how they worked the mines, like King Solomon's mines, and how people like Herod, to get rid of Jesus Christ, had every young boy killed to keep him from growing up. What would we think of today if we had a president that decided that he wanted to accomplish something, and the only way he knew of doing it would have every kid, every boy under a year old killed in this country? What would be your reaction? You don't have to tell me. That was a practice back then. Look at the Passover. God did that one. The actual, not the feast, not the Passover feast, but the Passover. And it's over and over again, that's through the scriptures. That's through the early part of the Old Testament. That's the way they control things. That's the way they did. And that's part of their history because they hadn't learned what we know today yet. They didn't know it. For me to finally grasp that as I read the Old Testament, it took some real, looking in our mirror of humanity today and then comparing that to how they had to be doing that completely different back then from what we do today. And today we take it for granted, and we should. I mean, it's boilerplate. You know, you don't kill the boys and you have a value on a human life, and there's all kinds of things that we honestly, rightfully so, believe today. They didn't back then. And that goes all the way through Genesis. Look at Esau and Jacob. Jacob was a fake. Jacob was a phony. You know, he had hold of Esau's heel when he was born. Esau was a hunter. Jacob was a grifter. That's what Jacob means in Hebrew. But yet, when he repented, and I'm going to say it that way, in the Bible it says he wrestled with an angel. Well, he repented. When he repented, he still committed bigamy. That's how he got 12 sons, not from one wife. And those 12 sons became the 12 tribes of Israel. Reconcile that to what you think about today. I can't. So we get down to Joseph. Joseph had a bunch of brothers. Joseph was a favorite of Jacob. He had his, quote, coat of many colors. That made his brothers mad. They dug a pit and threw him in it. And they sold him to the Ishmaelites. Ishmaelites were Ishmael's people, the bandits. The bandits took him to Egypt. And through God's intervention, and I don't think that was a mistake, even though he was thrown in the pit, and envy was the driving force of that, and the violence of selling him off, selling your brother off, of course Reuben wouldn't do any, he didn't want him to kill, so they just sold him. And they get down to Egypt, and that's where he started interpreting dreams for the Pharaoh. And that made him a governor. And I'm shortening this whole thing real quick here. But then he drew the disfavor of, I don't know whether it was a queen or what you call her. And she set him up, and he went into exile. And God knew this. For years he was in exile. He grew up in exile. But when it was all said and done, he became a governor of Egypt. Just in time to save his brothers and Israel from starvation with a famine. God did that. Why didn't he just make him the governor of Egypt and not have to go through all of this other stuff? Because God knew better. For me, he's building character. I mean, that's the only thing I know. He was just building character, but I don't know that for sure. It doesn't say that. But that was God's decision to do things like that. All right? He brings his family in. He gets them settled down in Egypt. They prosper. And as a matter of fact, they prosper so much that before long, the then Pharaoh starts looking at him as a threat. So he tells the midwives, the Hebrew midwives, that whenever a Hebrew boy is born, kill it. And they won't do it. They say, well, we always get there too late, and you know, they called us too late, and we didn't get there in time for the delivery, so we didn't get that done. So the Pharaoh starts killing them. He has the boys' underwear, the newborn boys, killed because he's afraid that the Jews or the Israelites are going to overwhelm Egypt because there's so many of them. They have multiplied so much. Now, does this sound like a nice, quiet, rosy story of God? But it's a story of God. All right? We know Moses was born, and he was hidden in a little basket, you know, in the river. And I think it was a king's daughter or something found him. And got his mother there to take care of him. And then when he grew up, he killed an Egyptian that was beating a Hebrew. So he's exiled for 40 years. And God allowed it. So finally, that Pharaoh dies. And God tells Moses, who is now an adult, you go tell this Pharaoh to let my people go. And that's a short way of saying it. But God hardens Pharaoh's heart, and he won't let the Israelites go. 10 times. There's 10 plagues that God put on the Egyptians, not the Hebrews, not the Israelites. The Israelites didn't suffer from that, but the Egyptians suffered from all 10 plagues made by God. He wanted a division there, so this is my thinking. He wanted a division there so sharp and so wide and so solid that they'd never go back. And if they did, they wouldn't be accepted. So finally, he lets them go. They cross the Red Sea. They start a life of their own. They were promised a land of milk and honey, which was Canaan. And there was half a dozen pagan tribes that were in charge of that, or in control of that country at that time. So they had to get strong enough to overwhelm him, because, as you know, when he told them to go in, when they finally went in after 40 years, they had to destroy everybody and everything that had to do with those civilizations. And they didn't. They kept some of this stuff as booty or loot or whatever you want to call it. They disobeyed God. But in the meantime, they no more than get into the wilderness, I'm going to call it, because that's what the Bible calls it. 2 years after they got their exodus from Egypt, and God tells them, you need a military draft. This is the first chapter of Numbers. And I want every man, every able-bodied young man, 20 years and up, to be in the army. And you go in and you number all those men in these tribes, except for the Levites. The Levites were exempt. And you make an army. First chapter of Numbers, they start counting how many young men came out of each tribe. Well, by the time they got done, there were 600,000, over 600,000 young men that was in that army. If you take that and add a conservative number for each family, that's between 2.5 and 3 million people that were in the wilderness. To give you an idea, that's more people that are in the Kansas City metropolitan area. So if you want to get an idea of how they're spread out and how packed they were, I guess you'd say, next time you're in an airplane, look at the Kansas City metropolitan area when you're coming in. The square miles and square miles of just stuff. But today, we have sanitary facilities, we have an infrastructure. We have food transfers, we have water, we have electricity, which of course they didn't have. They didn't have water. They didn't have any way of getting food. And Moses had to provide it. So they go to Moses. Moses goes to the Lord. Every morning they get manna, every evening they get quail. Moses struck a rock with a rod, with his staff, and produce water for 2.5 million people daily for 40 years. And the reason he did that was the minute they got over into their wilderness, they rebelled. So that generation had to die off before God let them into the promised land, according to what the scriptures say anyway. Talk about decision making. You know the logistics of providing food and water and safety and comfort, I guess you'd say, to 2.5 to 3 million people? Take a look at our infrastructure that we have today for this metropolitan area. The health department, the water department, I want to say the street department. That was on Moses' back. That's what Moses had to do. And he had to start from scratch because he didn't know anything. For example, 18th chapter of Exodus. His son-in-law, or his father-in-law is there, and he seeing Moses set as a judge from daylight to dark for everybody all by himself. I know for a fact now that what you get when you do that is decision fatigue, and pretty soon your thought process goes out the window and your emotions take over. You just want to get things done, which isn't the way to do it. Jethro brought that to Moses' attention. Moses goes to the Lord, and he comes up with an organizational structure that we still use. Every business that's got 10 people use this today in the world. I don't care whether you're a Christian nation or a non-Christian nation. You have to use this organizational structure. If you want to look at it, it's got the structure, it's got how, it's got your how many people within each tier of the hierarchy. Everything's in the Bible. And when you really get to looking along in that part of the Bible, they've got rules for everything they do, which is everything we do today, is in there. Some of it you've got to kind of look for. When they had the rules for the Levitical priest on processing their sacrifices, when it comes to the meat, it's supposed to be cooked, and they're supposed to take enough meat, cooked meat, for 2 days, because of course they didn't have refrigeration back then. And what happens when you have cooked meat for 3 days in the heat? Everybody knows what it is. But he had to tell them that. He called it, if you eat it on the third day, it's an abomination. In other words, you get sick. Everything, and they didn't know this. Things that we take as boilerplate today, things we do automatically today without thinking, they knew nothing about. And God had to teach them. And it's so powerful, and it's so all-pervasive, or it permeates everything in our life today so much that we still do all of it. We honestly do. Sometime, take the time to go through the law and see what it tells you about us today. Let me give you an example, a quick example, if I can dig it up here. And Jesus covered it in the Sermon on the Mount. That's too far. I didn't think to do this, so I got to look it up. Matthew 5, verse 38. Ye have heard that it hath been said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other. And if any man will sue thee at law, take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also. Okay, that was his instructions on that law that's in Exodus. And that is in Exodus 21. Every time that I have heard the country of Israel get ready to strike back at an attack today, I hear an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. They still say that. Here, That's revenge. And that's exactly what they still do today. They still intone that before they start the battle. Exodus 21. And here we go with laws concerning acts of violence. Here's a subtitle. Starts in verse 12, but I'm going to go down to verse 22. If men strive and hurt a woman with child so that her fruit depart from her, she has a miscarriage. And yet no mischief follow, if the child doesn't die, he shall surely be punished according as a woman's husband will lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. And if any mischief follow, if the child dies, then thou shalt give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe. And that's where they got that. The only problem is that when this was given to Moses by God, nobody could read. So it was word of mouth. And over the thousands of years between when that was given to Moses and Jesus Christ talked about it on the Sermon on the Mount, it's like the old game of gossip. Definition went well out here. Because they had judges by now, right? Jethro made sure of that. Because that's how they handled those 3 million people. That's how Moses decided or ended up handling those 3 million people on the arguments that they were bringing before him. And their guidance was to handle crime. A life for a life, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burning for burning, wound for wound, and stripe for stripe. Let the punishment fit the crime. And that was their instructions on how to enforce the law, or how to apply the penalties for enforcing the law. We still do that. You can't find a law back then that we still don't do today or that still isn't in effect today, because God was so complete in his laws and the way he laid things out, he thought of everything. And he thought of everything up front. But he allows people to die. Here in this country, Revolutionary War, Civil War, World War I, World War II, all the police actions that have occurred in between. That's what we call military things. And he didn't just haul off and take the bad guys and put them somewhere and let us go about our lives with all the peace and tranquility that you could muster. We had to get in there and go about it the hard way. And when we quit doing it the way we were supposed to be doing it, we've not won a war since. Because we're violating God's laws. We're violating the way he has laid out things to be. He's got a reason for people dying. What is it? What would have happened on this earth if nobody ever died? We'd be stacked 10 deep. I call it birth control or population control. And that's a hard way of looking at it. But when you take it all and you set it all down and look at it, that's what it is. He's keeping this place from being stacked 10 deep in people. Because he knew that would happen. God knows everything. And it isn't just the Bible that talks about things like this. It's the Book of Mormon too. The first one I know that God had killed in the Book of Mormon was Laban. And there's a reason for it. It tells you so. It's better that one man should lose his life than a whole nation should lose their souls. When you really get to looking at it, when you really get to looking at things and the instructions that are in the Bible and in the Book of Mormon, and you look at the history of things that happened, like in, well, first, I think the first place I've ever found is in Nehemiah, They arm people. And by arming people, there's no violence. When they were building the, in Nehemiah, that's when they were building the temple. And the enemy was trying to destroy the temple. So they armed half of the workers with spears and swords and whatever they armed them with during in that day and age. And they stood guard while the rest of them built the temple. And as they stood guard, the enemy didn't come attack them. And there was no violence. It's called peacemaking. And what is a peacemaker? Blessed are the peacemakers. That's what Jesus Christ said. But you got to know the difference between peacemaking and violence. And that's in there. There's all kinds of things that when we... I can be a right-wing militant, which I'm not, and I can justify my actions in the Bible if I want to twist things around enough. I can be a left-wing liberal pacifist, and I can justify my actions by pointing out things in the Bible. It all depends on how much I want to twist them, how much I want to skew them around to fit my way of thinking or to fit my perspective. And the world and history is full of those things, and we still fight it today. That's why we're a natural enemy to God. We still use our emotions too much instead of really, and I'm not talking about reading, I'm not even talking about studying, but I'm talking about getting into this, into the instructions that are in the Old Testament, which are valid. The way of worship and all of that is no longer valid. You know, that went the way with Jesus Christ. We all know that. But what did he do on the Sermon on the Mount? He went right back to the laws in the Old Testament. And he says, this is what it says, and this is how you're misusing it. And he did that with everything. And that was his first sermon over there that's recorded. And that was his first sermon over here on this continent that was recorded. It was his Sermon on the Mount. Because the first thing that he's thinking about is our behavior. And our behavior is controlled by our attitude, our spirit. So why doesn't, well, I'm getting off on that. So why doesn't God worry about all of the people that are killed because of his actions? And I've already talked about that. I'm just summarizing it. It's our souls. What does he look at? What's the first thing he looks at? Tells you in the Book of Mormon. He brings your life before you when you go before the judgment seat. There's 108 people die a minute on this planet. So you've got a little over a half a second to plead your case when you go before the Lord. Now, I don't know about you all, but I'm not that glib. I'm not that persuasive. As a matter of fact, when I die, all of a sudden, God's in charge. And he's got a plan. And that is, he brings your life before you, and those things that you had not been forgiven of makes you turn in shame away from him. He doesn't turn you away. You do it yourself. And that should be our focus. What does it take to honestly repent and forsake, like it says in the Book of Mormon, to repent and forsake our sins and ask in humbleness of heart that we be forgiven? Because that's what it says. And I don't know how many ways I can wiggle out of that. Because you can't. So what do we concentrate on? When we're studying our scriptures and we go to Sunday school class or or we have a study of some kind, or anything. There's a million ways of teaching the principles of God in such a way that we are looking at the welfare of our souls. I've had, well, when I was traveling, somebody would come up with somebody from another church would come up with some big doctrine thing to question me about, and I'd go, well, okay, what's that got to do with the welfare of my soul? Boy, did I ever get reactions. But it's true. What do those things have to do with the welfare of my soul or your soul? Shouldn't we be concentrating on things that have to do with the welfare of our souls? How are you going to learn? We all still have to learn. I still have to learn. The more I read, the dumber I feel. Oops, I should have been doing that. Oh my gosh, I never thought of that before. We're the Church of Christ. I really honestly believe that. I really honestly believe that. What does that mean? Does it mean we're the Church of Christ? What did Christ teach? Everything that had to do with the welfare of our souls. And all he was doing was reinforcing what God laid down in the first five books of the Old Testament about the welfare of our souls. Whether it's finances, whether it's warfare, whether it's health, whether it's treating your neighbor correctly or incorrectly, I don't care. Even your attitude. Look at the woman at the well. Now, I've talked about that before. There's Jesus Christ going into this well, Jacob's well, I think is what they called it. And there's a woman from Samaria there, and the minute that he asked her for some water, she said, what are you talking to me for? We're supposed to be enemies. That's her opening salvo. And by the time he gets done talking to her, she says, oh, well, you must be a prophet. Well, did he do that with magic? No. He did that with all of the things that we teach you on how to handle people. And it's not something on a grease board with four bullets. It's all through this Bible, and it's all through this Book of Mormon on how to handle people. And you got to find it. If it's handed to you, you're going to tend to forget it. If you got to hunt it up and you got to work hard to find it, you're going to remember it. Or you have a better chance of remembering it. So that's what we should be doing. And every time that I'm set, and I don't have to be involved in anything. If I'm sitting in a class and they're talking about something, I've gotten the habit of saying to myself, now see, what's that got to do with the welfare of my soul? And if I can't come up with an answer, I just look out the window. I'm not going to berate them. I'm not going to belittle them. What does that do? It makes them defensive. And they start calling me arrogant. And then they won't listen to me. The Good Samaritan. This guy gets waylaid by robbers and he's laying in, seriously injured in the ditch. And this Levite walks by. Now, who's a Levite? A Levitical priest. A man of the church. And by the way, you didn't have to be good to be a Levitical priest. All you had to be was a Levite. And there's a story about that in Samuel that you ought to read. So anyway, so here's this guy laying in the ditch, and this Levite goes by and walks around on the other side. This other guy, I think he was a Jew, walks around and goes to the other side. I forget what the first guy was. And then here comes the Samaritan. And he recognized who this guy was, but he also knew he was in trouble. So he takes him down to the inn, and he fixes him up, does what they do for medical health back in those days, and then even pays the innkeeper to help convalesce him, and then says, if I owe you any more money, next time I come by, I'll pay you. Now that's what this Samaritan did to his enemy. So what's the point of the story? That's how you're supposed to treat your enemies. I have trouble with that because my emotions get in the way. And I've got to swallow hard. You want to really have to swallow hard, go arrest a child molester, and then protect him from the family of the victim. And you'll find out how hard that is. I know that. So what does it take to treat your enemies kindly? An attitude. Your soul, your spirit. What made him an enemy in the first place? Did they hold you up in an armed robbery? Did they beat you up? Did they hurt your feelings? Did they snub you? What was it that made them your enemy? Maybe you made them your enemy. Maybe. I don't know. There's a million reasons. That's just a few of them that I've named. But then what does Christ tell you about that? And the lawyer that was asking Jesus Christ that wouldn't even say it. Well, and so he's wanting to know who your neighbor was. That was the definition that caused that. Definition of who is my neighbor? And that's what Jesus Christ told him. So then Jesus asked him, he says, now, who's your neighbor? And the guy says, the guy that provides help. He wouldn't say a Samaritan. He wouldn't even say it then. That's what we have to contend with. But that's the lessons we have to learn. Those are the lessons that are all over in these two books. And sometimes you really have to study them to dig it out. We all know today that if you don't refrigerate meat on the third day, it spoils. They didn't back then. But it's part of that process of teaching those people back then what they didn't have any idea about. Back in 91, and I understand it's nowhere near that today, when we were in Yucatan, they didn't understand what a germ was. And we'd say, you got to wash your hands, because you got germs on your hands, and they'd go, this is what they do to me, show me. Back then, in Yucatan, if you had an appendectomy, your incision closed in 3 months. It's 1991, it's not that way anymore, but that's what it was back then. If a surgeon was working on an operation and he got a phone call, he went out in the hallway on the public phone and answered it and then came back in and finished the surgery. Because they didn't know any better. That was just to our south, and that was 1991. There was all kinds of things like that that we kind of, well, actually, offering a prayer over the food really became important down there. It really got to be important, especially after we saw how it was cooked. And they were doing the best they could. I mean, they were neat people. They were bending over backwards for us and all of this. They just didn't know. And I understand now they do. And they probably still treat us the same way. Just bend over backwards to do everything they can for us. Because they're people in our church, and they know what we believe, and we know what they believe. And you could walk into a group And when they realized who we were, you could tell instantly who a church member was by their spirit. And I'm sure that that's not just in Mexico, it's probably worldwide. So we have people that believe like we do. We have people that believe in Jesus Christ, and we have people that believe. They believe our Jesus Christ, I guess is the way you say it. They believe we believe in the way we should do our religion. You know, to give you an idea of how the world looked at religion and how the world looked at things, I'm going backing up a little bit. In the 1300s, they were starting to translate the Bible out of Latin, and the church back then just had a fit because they did not want the common man to be able to read that. Well, between becoming literate and Mr. Gutenberg, it really became something that was common. Everybody could do it instead of having to go to the priest and have him tell you what it was. And they felt so strongly about it, that church felt so strongly about it, that when John, I don't have to look it up here, hang on a minute. When John Wycliffe, in the 1300s, was the first one to translate the Bible out of Latin, and this was in Europe, so I'm not sure what language he translated it to. When they found out it was him that did that, the church looked for him forever, and he had been dead decades when they found out who it was. So to punish him, now he was dead, so to punish him, this is the way they thought back then. They dug him up and burned him and threw his ashes in a river. And when William Tyndale translated it into English, he was burned at the stake for doing that. So that's the first guy that gave his life that you and I might read what's in the Bible. And that was the 1300s and 1400s. It wasn't back in biblical times. This is the 1300s and 1400s. That was the prevailing attitude of those in control. So we're not that far removed. And Satan has, as far as I'm concerned, and this is just my opinion, Satan has really come up with new innovative ways of diluting the scriptures. Take a look at the mainstream churches today. And what's their focus? Finances. It's just finances. Kenneth Copeland has been an electronic minister evangelist for a long time. And here a few years ago, there was a preacher that put it out that he needed a bigger jet. He already had three, but he needed a bigger jet to get around. And he had all these ideas about why. And somebody asked Copeland, well, what do you think about this? And Copeland says, well, I think he needs it. He says, you know, he says, it's awful hard to be on a public jet, and you can't really raise your hands and praise the Lord because they throw you off for creating a disturbance. He says, and besides that, everybody's always after you to pray for them, and they're always interrupting your train of thought. Really? And that's modern ministry. There's a lady up in the Northwest whose mother lived up in Seattle. This is some of our church people. And they, I think it was a sister of hers that was sick. So she called her pastor to go, can you go visit my sister and pray for her? She says, sure. He says, that'll be $50. That's modern ministry. They have found out that these, I guess you call them progressive churches or whatever you want to, kind of a label you want to put on them. Of course, it's been all over the news now for quite a while that religion is shrinking in the United States. Well, those are the churches that are shrinking. But the churches that are growing are the conservative churches. I consider us to be sensibly conservative. I really do. There's some people we know down in Oklahoma that they got in the middle of all of this stuff with the Methodist Church about, you know, gays in the ministry and all of this stuff. And of course, that's destroyed that church. And he says what they're really starting up down there is house churches. Because you have church in your home. You get a bunch of people together and you have church in your home. And the minister doesn't get paid. We've been doing that forever. We're ahead of the curve on that one. But that's also becoming a thing. And to me, they may not be the Church of Christ, but they're getting rid of the things that I know that are just flat poisoning religion in this country. And God's doing that. Now, where he takes them, I have no idea. But at least I'm heartened by the fact that we're doing it right. I'm getting to the end of my life. You know, I'm old. I'm not going to tell you how old. But the things that I've heard and the things that I've read over the last, I'm going to say 20 years about religion in this country, I like to hear things like that about house churches, house services, and the conservative people starting to increase their church attendance and things like that, because it tells me that they may not belong to our Church of Christ, but at least they got people out there that are thinking about their souls. However misguided it may be, they're thinking about their souls. And they're realizing what's damaging their souls. And to me, that's encouraging. And I hope it continues. Thank you.